The following program is sponsored by the Citizens Committee for Eisenhower and Nixon.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're speaking from the main auditorium of Masonic Temple in Detroit, where a capacity crowd of wildly enthusiastic Detroiters are waiting to hear a major address by Dwight D. Eisenhower, the Republican candidate for President of the United States. Outside, the block square Cass Park is packed with people who couldn't find sitting or standing room in this immense, jam-packed auditorium. All day in Michigan, it's been the same story. Enthusiastic thousands lining streets and looking it up for Ike as he swizzles stops and caravan through the Detroit area. In just a moment, it all adds up to one thing: Michigan likes Ike. In just a moment, that hero and statesman, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Approaching the podium now to introduce him is Fred M. Alger, Republican candidate for governor of Michigan.
Ladies and gentlemen of Michigan and of the nation, it is my deep privilege and my high honor to present to you the next President of the United States, Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Mr. Alger, Mr. Alger, and my friends of this great metropolitan center, in this anxious autumn for America, one fact looms above all others in our people's mind. One tragedy challenges all men dedicated to the work of peace. One word shouts denial to those who foolishly pretend that ours is not a nation at war. This fact, this tragedy, this word is Korea. A small country, Korea has been for more than 2 years the battleground for the costliest foreign war our nation has fought, excepting only the two world wars. It has been the burial ground for 20,000 American dead. It has been another historic field of honor for the valor and skill and tenacity of American fighting men. All these things it has been, and yet one thing more. It has been a symbol, a telling symbol, of the foreign policy of our nation. It has been a sign, a warning sign, of the way the administration has conducted our world affairs. It has been a measure, a damning measure, of the quality of leadership we have been given. Tonight, I am going to talk about our foreign policy and of its supreme symbol, the Korean War. I am not going to give you elaborate generalizations, but hard, tough facts. I am going to state the unvarnished truth. What then are the plain facts? The biggest fact about the Korean War is this. It was never inevitable. It was never inescapable. No fact of prior history decreed that little South Korea in the summer of 1950 would fatally tempt godless communist aggressors as their easiest victim. No demonic destiny decreed that America had to be bled this way in order to keep South Korea free and to keep freedom itself self-respecting. We are not mute prisoners of history. That is a doctrine for totalitarians. It is no creed for free men. There is a Korean War, and we are fighting it for the simplest of reasons. Because free leadership failed to check and to turn back communist ambition before it savagely attacked us. The Korean War, more perhaps than any other war in history, simply and swiftly followed the collapse of our political defenses. There is no other reason than this. We failed to read and to outwit the totalitarian mind. I know something of this totalitarian mind. Through the years of World War II, I carried a heavy burden of decision in the free world's crusade against the tyranny then threatening us all. Month after month, year after year, I had to search out and weigh the strengths and the weaknesses of an enemy driven by lust to rule the great globe itself. Now, World War II should have taught us all one lesson. The lesson is that to vacillate, to hesitate, to appease, even by merely betraying unsteady purpose, is to feed a dictator's appetite for conquest and to invite war itself. That lesson, which should have firmly guided every great decision of our leadership through these later years, was ignored in the development of the administration's policies for Asia since the end of World War II. Because it was ignored, the record of those policies is a record of appalling failure. That record of failure dates back with red letter folly at least to September 1947. It was then that General Albert Wiedemeyer returned from a presidential mission to the Far East. He submitted to the president this warning, and I quote his words. The withdrawal of American military forces from Korea would result in the occupation of South Korea by either Soviet troops or, as seems more likely, by the Korean military units trained under Soviet auspices in North Korea. That warning and Wiedemeyer's entire report were disregarded and suppressed by the administration. The terrible record of these years reached this dramatic climax in a series of unforgettable scenes on Capitol Hill in June 1949. By then, the decision to complete withdrawal of American forces from Korea, despite menacing signs from the North, had been drawn up by the Department of State. The decision included the intention to ask Congress for aid to Korea to compensate for the withdrawal of American forces. This brought questions from Congress. the administration parade of civilian and military witnesses before the House Foreign Affairs Committee was headed by the Secretary of State. He and his aides faced a group of Republican congressmen who were both skeptical and fearful. What followed was historic and decisive. I beg you to listen carefully to the words that followed, for they shaped this nation's course from that date to this. Listen then. First, Republican Congressman John Lodge of Connecticut asked, "Do you feel that the Korean government is able to fill the vacuum caused by the withdrawal of the occupation forces?" The administration answered, "Definitely." Second, a very different estimate of the risk involved came from Republican Congressman Walter Judd of Minnesota, long a profound student of Asiatic affairs. He warned, "I think the thing necessary to give security to Korea at this stage of the game is the presence of a small American force and the knowledge on the Soviet side that attack upon it would bring trouble with us. I am convinced," Representative Judge continued, "that if we keep even a battalion there, they are not going to move. And if the battalion is not there," listen now to Judd's warning, "the chances are they will move within a year." What a tragedy that the administration shrugged off that so accurate warning. Third, the Secretary of State was asked if he agreed that the South Koreans alone, and I quote, "will be able to defend themselves against any attack from the northern half of the country." To this, the Secretary answered briskly, "We share that same view. Yes, sir." Rarely in congressional testimony has so much misinformation been compressed so efficiently into so few words. Fourth, Republican Congressman Lodge had an incisive comment on all this. "That," he said, "is wishful thinking. I am afraid it confesses a kind of fundamental isolationism that exists in certain branches of the government, which I think is a very dangerous pattern. I think the presence of our troops there is a tremendous deterrent to the Russians." Finally, this remarkable scene of the summer of 1949 ends with a memorable document. The minority report of five Republican members of the House Foreign Affairs Committee on July 26, 1949, submitted this solemn warning. Listen to it. "It is reliably reported that Soviet troops attached to the North Korean puppet armies are in positions of command as well as acting as advisors. This development may well presage the launching of a full-scale military drive across the 38th parallel. Our forces have been withdrawn from South Korea at the very instant when logic and common sense both demanded no retreat from the realities of the situation." And the report continues, "Already along the 38th parallel, aggression is speaking with the two familiar voices of howitzers and cannons. Our position is untenable and indefensible. The House," meaning the House of Representatives, "should be aware of these facts." Now, these words of eloquent, reasoned warning were spoken 11 months before the Korean War broke. Behind these words was a fervent, desperate appeal. That appeal was addressed to the administration. It begged at least some firm statement of American intention that might deter the foreseen attack. What was the administration's answer to that appeal? The first answer was silence, stubborn, sullen silence for 6 months. Then suddenly came speech. A high government official at long last speaking out on Asia. It was now January of 1950. What did he say? He said, the United States government will not provide military aid or advice to Chinese forces on Formosa.